Well, hey there. This is Hugh Halter, and I come to you from the very vacant, sad lobby of the business that I run called Post Commas. It's a all-day brunch cafe, coffee shop, and event center, and we are closed down, so I have plenty of time to talk to you. Justin gave me a call and just asked if I'd share a few words of encouragement. He said I could just tell you stories, but I thought we would go over kind of a topic of being the church when you can't go to church. So obviously this is a super weird time, but it is affording us all a chance to kind of rethink some pretty amazing things, isn't it, about our lives and what we're called to be and called to do. For our family, I will be honest with you and say that it's not that weird for us. We've been sort of doing church outside of church walls for about 30 years. My son Ryan has had really severe epilepsy. And so from, you know, he's 33 now. He almost died last week. He kind of almost always dies, but then he rallies. But he was not supposed to live past the age of 5. He was having sometimes 20 grand mal seizures a day. So, you know, our life was stuck at home. We literally couldn't leave the house much. So, you know, the idea of going to church was not really on the radar. Ends up that that's how God sort of taught us how to plant churches, more neighborhood churches, smaller, you know, networks of missionary communities. And so we've been doing that and going around the world, kind of helping leaders think through church outside of like the normal Sunday experience that I know many of us have grown into. I came to faith in that, so it was deeply impactful to me. It's just, you know, we had to change about 30 years before everybody else had to change. Kind of a crazy thought, March 15 of this year, 90% of the churches in America could not gather. Like on one day, about 90% of the churches had to stop doing what they were used to doing, which means that as, you know, folks that go to church, all of a sudden we had to change everything, how you viewed things and whatever. And so, you know, what might feel weird right now, I just want you to know it's not that weird. And I will tell you, living it for 30 years, there's some incredible benefits I want to get to by the end of this. But, you know, sometimes when people say, well, Hugh, how are you and the family doing? I just say we're doing like awesome. We're sort of like, I call it the corona cockroaches. We've learned to kind of move amidst the rubble for a long time and kind of sneak in and out and subversively work to just be in the lives of people. And yet I know that for many of you, that is not normal. So please don't feel any judgment or, you know, sense that I'm telling you how to do your life or how to do church. But I do want you to know that the future of the church is changing. You know, even before the coronavirus, you know, I've been probably working with 60 denominations. There's no denomination in America that's been on the incline. Everybody has been losing sort of market share for a long time. People are just not wanting to go as much. And those of us that have been going, it just doesn't seem to have the same meaning it used to. There's no loyalty to it anymore. We don't put our money in it much anymore. So, you know, the church was changing. If the virus had not come, you would have felt some slow incremental changes anyway. This just like, you know, sped it up for all of us to the point where we all had to go, oh, holy cow, like this is a whole new world. But I do want to give you a little bit of a history of the world just so you won't know that, you know, or at least you'll know you're not in a weird space and that you'll understand that God knew that this was coming. I don't think he started it, but he's allowed it. So, you know, you have to ask yourself the question of why would God not save us from this thing? And it might be that he is doing a much deeper, more substantial work in all of us. And it's really the way that he's worked throughout the history of the world. So, you know, if I could give you a history of the world or a history of the church in 5 minutes, it would be that prior to Jesus, it was a very religious world. People went to tabernacle. If you were a Hebrew, a Jewish person, and it was led by a priest, you would have had a place, you would have had a priest, and you would have had practices. And everybody had to do the same practices. You could turn your brain off at the door and just watch the pros do it for you. That's the way it was before Jesus. He comes on the scene then, not to create another religion for people to go to, but to create an alternative to religion. And I think sometimes we don't realize how amazing that was, but people liked religion. They found it comforting, and so they didn't like what Jesus talked about. He broke a lot of the religious rules, and it got him killed. Okay, so then Jesus rises from the dead, and he shows himself to about 500 people, blows their minds, and then later on, we're told that the same power that raised Jesus from the dead is now at work in us who believe. An unbelievable idea that the resurrected power is now in us. And so from the time of Jesus, he took away those three things that we always had. He didn't provide for us a priest anymore. He said that you guys are all going to be the priests now. So you don't get the person anymore to just lead you and tell you what to do. And all of a sudden, the church did not have a place anymore. They didn't have the synagogue or the tabernacles. They were mostly on the run. And so they had to gather mostly in houses, right? And in little alcoves and caves and along riverbeds and lakes and whatever. But they just couldn't meet in the big places anymore. And they didn't really have those rote practices, you know, those things that we all do, the three-song warm-up and then the announcements and then the sermon and the final song. They had to actually create and innovate their own spiritual practices that would hold them together and help them to be faithful to God. And so what's crazy is that they did that. And as Rome was the power that they all had to deal with and live under, all of a sudden, one by one, normal person by normal person, unprofessional, unpaid, no exchange of money, all of a sudden, these little disciples started to make other disciples, and they literally usurped Rome. Like, they took it out. And it's amazing, like, to think about that. You know, prior to that, the message gets to Constantine. So for, you know, picture time of Jesus for about 300 years, none of those three things. We have the fastest moving church we'd ever seen. All of a sudden, the Roman leader Constantine gets the gospel, and he buys it to such an extent that he now institutionalizes the church. You know, right around 300 after Christ. And he gave him back those three things. He gave him a place. He started to build buildings for him. He appointed bishops or priests again. And he told them what their practices were. And all of a sudden, the church lost its mission. Eventually, it was sacked by six different countries. And for about 200 years, we have what was called the Dark Ages, where you could not find a vestige of Christianity anywhere. The world got very dark. And then all of a sudden, around 300 years later, the whole known world is Christianized again. And people have, you know, they've tried to study that, and they go, well, what, you know, did it happen because we reinstituted Rome, or we re-educated people, or we reestablished all these churches? No, it actually, the second, what we call the Celtic revival, happened from the, you know, misty fog banks of Ireland and Northern Scotland. Again, these were unlearned, uneducated, crazy partiers that got the gospel and said, wherever we go, we're going to actually create gospel presence. And so, and then they re-Christianized the whole world in a couple hundred years. So again, I just wanted to kind of give you an idea. What you and I are going through is nothing weird to the Lord. It's actually how he begins to move the church again. And I'm under the perspective that God loves the church so much, he was not going to let us just keep doing church. And there's a lot of reasons, you know, related to, you know, our effect in the world, but it really has to do with you and I too. Just, you know, our ability to see the power of God in our own lives, see the resurrected power of Jesus living in us, in our own neighborhoods. And I know some of you are thinking, yeah, but that's like for weird people, the crazies, the extroverts. No, I'm an introvert. I don't like people either. Okay. I don't. I'd rather just golf by myself, except all the golf courses are closed. So I have been sneaking on, though. I take a 7-iron and one ball, and I go to this private course I would have never been able to get onto, and nobody's there. So I run 18 holes hitting this one ball. It's fantastic. Anyway, don't tell anybody that. But anyway, suffice it to say, you and I can do this, okay? Jesus has never changed. The same power that raised him from the dead, the same power that he promised to the church as he sent them out in Acts 1, is the same exact thing that you and I can live into. And so I want you to think about what this might mean for you and the story of your family. I will tell you, we have moved from our second church plant in Denver, Colorado, to a little town called Alton, Illinois. Much poorer, average family income is about $22,000. And my two adult daughters had experienced enough of our story that when we said, hey, we're thinking about leaving our incredible 4-acre horse ranch in Colorado and moving to this crappy, cruddy little town, they went, can we go with you? And so my two daughters and their husbands, all in their mid-20s, we all moved out here. We're not in our mid-20s, but we all moved out here not knowing what we were gonna do, and we just began to dive in. And God gave us this huge building. There was no coffee shop in our town. There was no place for people to connect. 22,000 is the average family income here, so it was very poor. About 40% African-American, the rest white, both sides very poor. And so we just have dove in. It's what you call the incarnation. So this, the new church, being the church without going to church, it's moving from a programmatic, show up, somebody else do something for us, like, the priest, as we say, Justin will do it for us. No, it's learning to live an incarnated life. We take that story from John 1:14. It says that the Word became flesh and he made his dwelling among us. And so we were able to perceive the glory of God. That's all, even evangelism, it just means to help people see the face of God. But we help them see God by how we embody. That's what incarnation means. It means to enflesh, or to carry within our own bodies the dying of Christ, is what Paul said, right? So that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. So literally Jesus's humanity is what showed people that God is not what they thought he was. Even when you think about the word evangelism, all that means is, it doesn't mean pissing people off by being rude to them religiously. Evangelism means to good news somebody. There was an Old Testament word called the Kadim, and it was describing the type of a God person. And the Kadim, the passage that comes to mind is Proverbs 11:10, where the righteous prosper, the city rejoices. The word righteous is Kadim. So the righteous ones are a type of a disciple that when they walk in the world applauds and says, thank you for being here. Imagine that. Now, if we look at all of our churches that were just fine before coronavirus, and we were to ask, do the people around our churches, do they stand on the streets and applaud our activity? Are they impressed by what we do? Are they excited that we're there in the neighborhood? I think most of us would have to go, probably not. But the original idea of what God was trying to send out into the world was these people that would be salt and light, right? They would bring the two most important things that culture needed at the time, something to preserve sustenance and to illuminate or make light, right? And so, you know, even when we came here and we got this building donated to us, that was really what we were asking. How do we good news our city? And because you couldn't find coffee, we thought, well, that could be good news. And because there's no place where people that of different economic values get together, or different skin colors, thought, well, if we could provide a daytime space, maybe that would happen. And sure enough, our incarnatedness began to kind of move us to what we call kind of the second part of incarnational life, which is a reputation. People start to say things about us. I'm going to have Justin put a grid up for you. It's just really what we call the flesh grid. And it goes from incarnation to reputation. Eventually, it's going to move to conversation, which we'll talk about in a second. And then there's going to be a confrontation of sin. People are going to know that they need something from God. And eventually there's a transformation of life. But I think what God is doing for all of us right now is he's not putting a safety net around. He's not just going to let us go back to church. He's literally going, I need you to be out there with everybody, the normal people. And I need you to be an amazing person amongst the normal people. And I need you to be these kadim, the ones that bring righteousness and justice and compassion and community to a world that right now doesn't have any of those things. I need you to be the people of peace. When people have no peace, I want them to see your face and know that you actually have peace. When the greatest need right now in the world is isolation and loneliness, when you guys create community, be it 20 people, 30 people, 12 people, you are bringing a little bit of heaven to earth. You're bringing the kingdom of God. And so that's what that means. And you start to get a reputation. People will talk to you. There's people that have come up to me in the grocery stores and have tapped me on the shoulder. They say, hey, are you the guy that runs the Post Commons? And I'll go, yes, ma'am, or yes, sir. And they will say, yeah, we heard about you guys and what you guys have done in our community. I've had people come up and just thank me. Thank you for coming to town. I never thought that was that big a deal to come to a town or to move in, but that's literally what incarnation means. You move in to the neighborhood, right? Or you move in, or you cross a cubicle, you cross a street. And incarnation, by the way, it's not just like going at people evangelistically. It really has more in mind the heart of adoption, adopting new friends into the family. It's not about converting people to a religion. So it's a long-term posture where people just know that you're in their lives. You give them eye contact, right? You give them something they can't seem to get. You're the one that says to them, hey, I've got half a day free on Saturday. Why don't we hang out? And people will go, who would give me half a day? Even if you say, hey, I know you've been going through a rough week. What do you think about, you know, having lunch next Tuesday? Just those types of things, I think, make us kadim, the righteous ones. And so people will begin to speak of you, and eventually you will get to have a conversation with people about the Lord. I have one benefit. Right around the corner here, there's a big, long coffee bar. And then right next to it is a whiskey bar. And I sit at the whiskey bar for many reasons. But one is so I can watch people come in the front door. And when I've seen them come in five or six times, I usually will go up to them and I'll say, hey, time for your 2-minute talk. And they go, what is that? And I usually will say, well, I can tell you've become a regular here. And they usually nod. And I say, well, regulars end up oftentimes being a part of our family. And so it helps me to remember your name if you would just give me 2 minutes of your story. And usually a 2-minute story is about 20 minutes or 2 hours. I had a 6-hour 2-minute story one time. But and eventually those people become friends. I find out more about their lives. Oftentimes I tell the rest of our spiritual community, our kind of our little Jesus community, about 40 people right now. I tell them ways that we can meet needs of people. And oftentimes they bring needs to me, and we just kind of band together as this little community of 40 or 50 folks. And we don't really always gather on Sunday, maybe sometimes to serve people. Every once in a while we get together and pray, but we've got a recovery house. We help people recover from addictive patterns. We've got some foster care scenarios in our community, and most of our people dive in pretty deep. We just took care of an elderly woman named Lona that had been stored up in her house for many, many years, living amongst cat pee and poo, and had grown used to it. And so we finally were able to get her after many, many months to go into an assisted living center. And a bunch of our community members went in just yesterday in hazmat suits and cleaned out her entire house so they could put it on the market. And they said they needed buckets and shovels to basically get all the shit out of the house. And that's kadim. That's the power of the righteous ones. We're not people that go to church on Sunday and wave and say, hey, how's your business going? And then see you next week. What if church was 20, 30, 40 friends in a given location? We all live within about 2 miles of each other, where we see each other all the time, same coffee shops, we work out together, our friends that we're connecting with that don't know Jesus begin to connect with us, where we find out their needs and we just spontaneously meet them all the time. What if that whole thing was church? And I don't mean that like to just like make light of the idea of church, but that was church. That's why I gave you kind of the history of the world. That was how the Christian people took over the universe twice is not by going to church. They took it over by being the called out Kadim, the righteous ones. And so there's a pastor out of New York City that talked about that passage where, you know, for people to line the streets and applaud, they were basically welcoming a new king in. The idea was that there would be a brand new empire that would be taking over, and it would not be the oppressive regime that they were under, be it the Romans or the Babylonians. But Jesus, when he said, hey, good news, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, he was announcing a new kingdom. And it's a new kingdom where there is community and there is equity and there is reconciliation and there is the redemption of old crappy buildings and poor cities, and there's all sorts of stuff. And then people talk about Jesus. People just want to, and it's happened. Cheryl and I started a little thing every other Wednesday night called The Abbey, and that's 40 other friends that are not Jesus followers, but they've all sort of at some point or another come to us and asked us about God stuff. So they saw it in us, and they would bring up something that they were thinking about or they wondered about. And Cheryl and I finally sent out an email to all of them just saying, hey, if you're getting this email, it's because we love you, for one, and number two, because every one of you have asked us about God stuff. And so we just said, we'd love to have you over every other Wednesday night and just have some nice wine and cheese and food and walk you through the teachings of Jesus without any religious BS. And all 40 of them said yeah. And so that's just to give you a picture. People want to talk about Jesus. They just don't want to talk about organized religion. They don't want to talk about right wing, left wing. They're not interested in Trump's spirituality. But they are certainly looking for the good news of a new empire that brings all this beauty and justice and mercy and kindness into the world. So you don't have to be afraid of that. They actually will love Jesus if we can just stop being so darn churchy. And so just to kind of frame it again, we dive in incarnationally. We begin to get a reputation as God's people, and they begin to talk with us about the Lord, and we begin to talk with them about our lives and what the Lord has done. And eventually they bring their own sin to us. We don't have to confront. People just bring it to us. I had this little gal that we let use our kitchen to start a bakery who proclaimed to me that she was an atheist. Was going through, she's kind of recovering from meth and other drug addiction issues. And she came to me a few weeks ago and just said, hey, is there a way you could talk to my husband? I think my addictive patterns are getting too hard for him, and I just thought you might be somebody that would be good. He respects you and whatever. And so that's how sin will be confronted. That's how people will say, hey, I need help. And so you never have to worry about that. And eventually, hopefully, there's transformation. Hopefully, maybe over time, they'll get to be in this something like the Abbey or a community of friends where we just walk through the stories of Jesus and see how it goes. But I'll just leave you with this. I feel like, and I tell this to leaders all the time, very rarely have I had a chance to talk to more congregational members like this, but I would encourage you not to let it go back to normal. Even if the rhythms of church go back, don't just go back. And challenge the rhythms. You know, ask, why are we gathering? What purpose are our gatherings? Do they support our scattered lifestyle as missionary communities? How can we move our small group to not just be in a Bible study, but how can we move into our neighborhoods and really embed the gospel? Just don't go back to normal. Why would you want to settle for a person and a place and practices? Why wouldn't you want to instead live a story where you get to see the power of God show up, and maybe a story big enough that your own kids someday will want to go on mission with you? That'd be kind of cool, wouldn't it? It has been cool for me. And maybe the best thing in my life is that we've got to see a lot of our friends come to faith, and our own children are now leading us in mission. I'm 53. I'm still introverted. I still don't like people, but I'm sure glad God does. and keeps pulling me into it. So I just want to give you just kind of a final blessing that God would fill your heart with love for people that you didn't used to love before. I pray that he would interrupt your lives and just pester you until you relinquish control, and to the point where you would give somebody even an hour or half a day. I pray that he would give you wisdom to know the friends to go on mission with and who God is sending you to. I pray that you would have faith, that just as the Holy Spirit guided the early church through all sorts of weird, terrible things, that he will easily guide us through the season, and that we will come out of this not as going back to church people, but as the new church and what God is doing for the future of our own children and the future of the church here in America and around the world. So big love to you from Alton, Illinois, and